Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens.
So
are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passeran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by Dr. Stanislav Wysocki, who is the author of the book American Antifa. Stas, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We spoke to you a few years ago now when the book came out. Could you just remind our listeners a little bit about who you are and how you sort of got into researching anti-fascist movements?
So I'm a sociologist, a professor of criminology, actually, and I got into researching anti-fascism largely because of my background in punk subculture in the primarily 1990s. And this was a time when there was a fairly large presence of neo-Nazi and fascist skinheads within that punk scene. And so it was a common occurrence to have anti-fascist conflicts within the punk scene and to have to be somebody who might be worried for their safety, as myself being a Jewish person, but also as an anti-fascist because of the potential violence of racist skinheads. And that really drew me to wanting to understand fascism in the far right. And that was what I initially studied, was fascism in the far right, and still an area that I cover in a lot of my research. And I came to studying anti-fascism primarily because of my experiences both in the punk scene and also within anti-fascist movements, and found that the perspectives that a lot of my colleagues in sociology had about anti-fascism were not reflective of what the reality of that movement was. So when it came time for me to do my dissertation, I decided I was going to focus on anti-fascist activists. And so I interviewed 24 anti-fascist activists in North America, and they've fairly evenly divided between about a dozen of what I refer to as non-militant anti-fascists, or what people sometimes call liberal anti-fascists, and then about a dozen militant anti-fascists. And I supplemented that with ethnographic research with anti-fascist activists, and that led to the writing of the book.
Stas, I have two questions. One is, what's become of the boneheads in 2025? And secondly, do you think that the quality of the scholarship on the subject has improved in the last, say, 20 years?
So in terms of the first question, the boneheads, the racist neo-Nazi skinheads who are derogatorily referred to as boneheads because the genuine skinhead subculture has its roots in Jamaican youth and Jamaican immigrant youth in the UK. So the people who refer to themselves as traditional or more authentic skinheads refer to the racist and Nazi skinheads as boneheads. And the boneheads are still around. They're still out there. They're still being Nazis and causing trouble and being a pest to a lot of people, and certainly engaging in the kind of violence that they've become known for. But they're not the only subculture that young people can get involved with that has a fascist element. There's a wide variety of subcultures now that have fascist tendencies or fascist elements or have a fascist version of the subculture. And so where the boneheads were the primary subcultural form of fascism in the 80s and 90s, and maybe even early 2000s, they're now just one of a kind of web of subcultures that people who are fascist can be involved in. So they're still around. They're unfortunately still a problem, but they're also not the only subcultural problem. So that's kind of what became of them. And then in terms of the quality of scholarship, I would say that it is definitely improving. It's becoming something that is much more rooted in a genuine understanding of anti-fascism and involves genuine research with anti-fascist activists or within anti-fascist cultures and movements. And it's become very global. So I am a member of and the North American coordinator of the Worldwide Anti-Fascism Research Network, which is a network of scholars globally who are studying anti-fascism. And through that network, we have been able to develop a number of projects. We've had some academic conferences, and those have led to the publications of special issues of journals that focus on anti-fascism. And there's several other journals coming out soon and book projects coming out of that network. So we're really starting to see anti-fascist scholarship develop. It's still very, very small and has a very sort of core number of scholars who are involved, but it's growing and certainly improving in the quality.
Stas, you guys are not the only people looking into anti-fascism. There's also the federal government of the United States has expressed an interest lately. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about the National Security Presidential Memorandum number 7 and what it does?
Yes. So the National Security Presidential Memorandum 7, or the NSPM 7, as it's known, its shortened version, it is an official order from Donald Trump, and we have to differentiate that from the executive order that he had. The executive order is just kind of like a statement, essentially saying, I hereby declare Antifa domestic terrorist organization, which has no legal binding and no legal framework. But the NSPM 7 actually does have legal binding and framework. And what it does is it focuses federal law enforcement activity in the United States on investigating anti-fascist activism. And the definition of anti-fascism that they use both in the executive order and in the NSPM 7 and subsequent documents is extremely broad and extremely vague. And it's clearly designed to not only serve as a tool of repression for what most people would understand to be Antifa activists, that is the people who dedicate their time and dedicate their efforts to finding out who fascists are and essentially making it hard for them to be part of that fascist movement, the people we would associate with Antifa affinity groups or collectives or groups of that sort. So it focuses on them, certainly. It sees them as a threat, particularly some of that language around doxing in the NSPM 7 is clearly meant to focus in on Antifa activists in North America. And then, of course, there is the breadth and the vagueness of the NSPM 7, particularly around language around funding and around a network of Antifa activism that supposedly spans from your researcher who's looking into fascists on their own to apparently nonprofit organizations and other kinds of global entities that are tied to wealthy philanthropists. And somewhere in between that are major members of the Democratic Party and really ultimately anyone who opposes the Trump administration has been defined by this NSPM 7 as being Antifa and therefore worthy of criminal investigation.
Stas, it's been reported that, and it seems to be the case, that Antifa in North America has not been especially active in the recent period. So I'm wondering, why do you think the Trump administration has decided to focus its energies upon prosecuting a war against anti-fascism at this moment? And what do you think that the specter of Antifa represents? How does this bogeyman essentially function politically to the advantage of the Trump administration?
So Antifa has been a convenient boogeyman for the right. It's something that exists a lot more in the imagination of people on the right in the United States than the reality of what Antifa activism actually entails. And there's been this very active construction of an Antifa boogeyman as a Black Bloc activist. So there is a very intentional conflation of Black Bloc, which is a tactic that has been used by Antifa activists, but is not exclusive to Antifa activists, conflating that with anti-fascism and Antifa activism. And then conflating the Black Bloc tactic with rioting, property destruction, and particularly acts of violence. So that's one step of this construction of the boogeyman. And then by doing that, they were able then to construct any kind of militant protest as something that is dangerous and threatening and potentially extremely dangerous and violent. Which then brings us to the summer of 2020 and the racial justice uprisings that happened in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, where there was, in many cities around the United States and certainly around the world, there were protests in opposition to police violence, police use of force, and certainly police murder of individuals, particularly people of color. And certainly in some cities in the United States, there were militant protests and people did engage in acts of property destruction that primarily focused on representations of that police violence. So people are probably familiar with the burning of the Third Precinct in Minneapolis that happened shortly after the murder of George Floyd. So acts like that were then turned into and conflated with Antifa somehow because of the kind of property of if Black Bloc equals Antifa and property damage equals Black Bloc, then Black Bloc must equal the movement for Black Lives for some strange reason. And so in the imagination of the right, Antifa represents this violent force that is trying to engage in attacks upon conservatives for supposedly their beliefs, although Antifa activists will say that they're not interested primarily in the beliefs of individual fascists. They're interested in the violent actions of individual fascists. And so it becomes a very convenient boogeyman, especially because of the unfortunately, to some extent, secretive nature of the way in which Antifa activists have had to engage in their activism for their own safety, really. And so Antifa is something that its narrative is often written by others, by people in the public sphere. And because the right has a very large mouthpiece, both in terms of news networks in the United States and also very popular networks in terms of quote unquote alternative media, although that alternative media is really big name podcasts with millions of listeners and things of that nature. But because of this network of media that is able to present this image of the black clad Antifa rioter, it creates an easy boogeyman to scare a right wing base in the United States. And this then makes Antifa a vulnerable subject because it is framed as this supposed violent opposition to the right. It is easy to focus on for law enforcement because it's framed as a criminal entity. And then because Antifa is more of a concept, a way of being in opposition to fascism, it opens it up to a wide range of interpretations, which then allows the Trump administration to criminalize a vast section of its opposition as anti-fascist, as interestingly enough, of course, the Trump administration is behaving in ways that are increasingly fascist. So when it is called out for being fascist, it creates this dynamic where opposition to the Trump administration and to its fascist policies, because it is anti-fascism, can also then be criminalized and can be focused on and used as a way of repressing the opposition And I just want to add another element to this. When we focus on the Antifa activism that is engaged in by people who are doing the kind of sustained work, the affinity groups, the anti-fascism from below is what scholars sometimes refer to it as. When we focus on those kinds of formal and informal anti-fascism is what I call it. Those are also the people who are likely to be the most militant and vigorous opposition. And so if you can take out your most militant and your most vigorous and often your most ideologically committed opposition first, then the repression of the rest of the opposition, your more mainstream liberals, people who are a little bit more milquetoast in their tactics and in the way in which they're going to oppose things, becomes that much easier. Because you've already taken out the people who are willing to fight back, and then you can suppress everyone else after that.
Stas, one thing that's been interesting about the coverage of the Antifa crackdown is that even as Fox News and Newsmax and company lose their minds over it and the wave of violence that is unfolding, actual footage of Antifa on the ground is often a little bit more lighthearted. We've seen, you know, the inflatable frog suits and things. Could you speak a little bit about, I guess, the use of humor by anti-fascists and how that plays into this whole thing?
Of course. So humor's always been an element of anti-fascist activism and anti-fascist tactics. In different times, it's been deployed as a way of disarming fascist opposition and in conjunction with the public shaming campaigns that anti-fascists often engage in when they publicize information about fascists. Humor can be used to denigrate and to shame and to make fascists feel less powerful. And that's really important because so much of fascism is about trying to construct the fascist as a powerful warrior figure who is able to use violence and suppress their opposition and the people whom they hate through this use of violence. So humor is a great way to disarm that and has been used to disarm fascists in the past. And what we're seeing now tactically is that use of humor as a great ironic juxtaposition. When you have these masked, highly militarized agents of the state and agents of the particularly racist immigration enforcement in the United States engaging in everyday acts of violence as part of their process of detaining people for deportation, and you juxtapose that against a series of protesters who are wearing inflatable costumes and they're having a dance party and playing music and having fun. And the response to that is this hyper-violent, militarized deployment of chemical agents and the use of violence against them. It really lays bare that contradiction and has a way of laying bare the way in which this actions of the state are so much rooted in violence and violent suppression of opposition. So it has that same element of being able to present the state as being an actor that is engaging in unjust and immoral actions. And it has a positive effect, of course, on people who are opposed to the actions of the state, to opposed to the violent deportations that are ongoing in the United States and are a daily occurrence in many American cities, because it gives the opposition a feeling that they have a strength in being able to mobilize in a way that isn't necessarily going to be directly confronting or fighting with these elements of the state, but has a way of getting people out there and bringing people together and mobilizing them in a way that might be a little bit safer than what they typically associate with anti-fascist or Antifa activism. And certainly we've heard from some of the people in the inflatable costumes that they are helpful to some extent as being padded and having certain kinds of ventilation that have made them a fairly effective armor, as it were, against the kind of violence that they're facing.
Stas, the roundtable that was held in Washington recently allowed for a range of people you might otherwise describe as right-wing influences to present some kind of evidence to the public with regards to the dangerous nature of anti-fascism. And on the one hand, I suppose much of that material seems weak and the scenario as a whole somewhat farcical, but nonetheless, as you've indicated, this attack is intended to have consequences for politically active people in the United States. I'm wondering, how do you think, I suppose apart from humour on the streets and so on, how do you think it's best to approach these kinds of fictions and to defend anti-fascism from those who may, in fact, be somewhat sympathetic to fascism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'd want to start maybe by just commenting on the roundtable itself and saying I think it says a lot about the perspective and the position of the administration and the federal government right now that they organize a roundtable on anti-fascism that is entirely filled with people who have known connections to fascist and far-right groups and have made statements in support of fascism in the past and have been seen on video laughing with Proud Boys and other far-right activists prior to them attacking anti-fascists. So it's telling that these are the so-called experts when there's clearly a number of, they're relatively small, but a number of genuine experts on anti-fascism. So when you're relying on fascist effectively experts, quote unquote, to give you the perspective on anti-fascism, that is really telling about the political perspective you're coming from. In terms of how to respond to that, the clear and most important thing to do is to become aware of the reality of anti-fascist activism, to understand that to be anti-fascist means to take a position in opposition to the politics of fascism, the politics of believing in inherent inequality that is enforced through violence and standing in opposition to that, knowing that anti-fascists are trying to create a more just world for everyone rather than a world of exclusivity for one small group of people. And then coming to understand that the way in which anti-fascist activists are trying to achieve that world is primarily by engaging in activities that are not violent. The vast majority of what Antifa activists and the kind of Antifa activists that are being constructed as this boogeyman image, the vast majority of what those Antifa activists do is nonviolent, fairly routine forms of activism. It is primarily intelligence gathering and trying to develop information and understanding of fascism as an ideology, fascist movements and how they operate, and key individuals involved in fascist movements who might be potentially dangerous to an immediate community and into a wider society. And then making that information public, engaging in education campaigns to let people know that that's what is happening, that that's who these people are, this is what fascism is, this is how fascism operates, that these are the core activities of what people who are Antifa do, and that's something that's very important to get across when someone starts talking about Antifa and certainly violent Antifa, and understanding that a lot of Antifa activism is culture. It's music, it's art, it's humor, it's styles of dress sometimes. It's things that people do for fun. A lot of it is just Antifa. In my research, I went to movie nights and to DJ nights at bars, to, you know, a fairly small scale, but musical events like shows with bands and things of that nature. A lot of that is also Antifa. Antifa is developing a culture where fascism isn't tolerated, where fascism is not allowed to seep into the culture, which is a huge strategy for fascists. So they refer to it as metapolitics of becoming involved in and turning the culture towards fascism. So a lot of what Antifa activists are doing is trying to create a culture in opposition to that. And being aware of those sorts of things and communicating that Antifa isn't some scary black bloc person who's going to assault you is an incredibly important thing to understand.
I guess going back to the Worldwide Anti-Fascism Research Network, Staz, can you, having already outlined its broadly its nature and activity, what would you like to see WARN achieve in the near future?
Well, the research network is primarily academic, so what we do is we try to facilitate opportunities for us to be able to do research and to share our research primarily in the academic sphere. But as a network, I certainly would like to see us grow. I'd like to see more scholars coming to us. We do have a website that people can access if they're interested in it. The website is antifascismresearchnetwork.com. And so people can check it out. It has histories of anti-fascism from different countries and a bibliography of, I believe at this point, it's hundreds, if not thousands, of works of scholarship on anti-fascism from a variety of disciplines, ranging from history to sociology, that cover anti-fascism in a variety of national and cultural contexts. So having people engage with that material and use it as a learning resource would be really great. And certainly as we grow the network, we want to ideally be a voice for and a way of being able to communicate the genuine understanding of what anti-fascism is from the perspective of anti-fascists themselves, whether that's historical perspectives or whether that's contemporary anti-fascist activists. We want to be able to convey that, and that's primarily what I believe to be our goals.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. That website again is Anti-Fascism Research Network, and people can find you on Blue Sky at professorstaz.bsky.social. Stanislav, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me again. It's a great conversation.
Well, Andy, that is our program. We will be back next week. See you later.
See you then.
The LGBTIQA+ Multicultural Fair Day will be held in the city of Whittlesea this year. Funded by Whittlesea City Council and auspiced by Australian LGBTIQA+ Multicultural Multifaith Council, the fair will have a strong human rights social justice focus as experienced through an intersectional lens. The event is held in a safe, supportive, inclusive space consisting of art and skills-based workshops by Street Art Doyle Blender Studio, African drumming, recycled fashion and sustainable gardening, information stalls, food and giveaways. The LGBTIQA+ Multicultural Fair Day, Saturday, November 8th, 3:30 till 7:30 p.m. at the Barry Road Community Activity Centre, 36 Barry Road, Thomastown. On-site parking available, entry is free and all are welcome. Whittlesea City Council is a 3CR supporter.
Hello there, I'm Virginia from The Gardening Show. What if there was a viable solution to climate change? Treasured Perennials Nursery are sponsoring a screening of Kiss the Ground documentary, exploring how, through our soils, we can stabilise the Earth's climate, restore lost ecosystems and provide future food security. A mini event with stalls, demonstrations and a Q&A session. It's going to be at Fernie Creek Horticultural Society, which is in Hilton Road in Sassafras, on November the 15th, 11:30 to 4 p.m. Tickets will be $15.50 through TryBooking. Head to trybooking.com and search for Kiss the Ground. All proceeds, of course, are donated to 3CR. Treasured Perennials Nursery is a 3CR supporter and regularly appear on The Gardening Show.